Welcome to The Get Together, a podcast for the live digital community.
All over the world, there are people thinking about and creating the future of live digital events and performances.
They are disparate innovators who are artists, tech founders, nonprofits, and investors, and they need a place to gather and share ideas.
And that's what The Get Together is all about.
I'm Joe, a tech and media startup vet with over 10 years of experience growing and operating businesses.
And I'm Jess, a theater creator who loves bringing people together around technology, art, and the internet.
And hey, we want to welcome you. Thanks for getting together with us. Let's dig in.
Episode number 2 of The Get Together, Joe. We made it. We're here. And it feels so nice.
Feels great whenever we're on the mics together.
Oh, so hip on the mics together. I really enjoyed our first episode, and I really love that it got to be sort of like a nod and Valentine to the, you know, 40 something episodes that came before it, really focusing on an article about tech and live and creators. It was really fun, and I listened back to it, and I really enjoyed it. Do you all enjoy it? If you did, let us know.
Yeah, let us know what you think about the new format. We're going to keep talking about articles. We're going to keep sharing our thoughts and ideas about that wonderful, beautiful intersection of technology and theater. We're going to talk to cool humans who sit at that intersection, too.
Yeah, we spend, I don't know, 27 out of 24 hours every single day thinking about live digital, making live digital, strategizing on live digital. You can put a ding sound effect in that because I told you I was going to try to use that word a lot. And so, of course, when we were thinking about revamping the podcast, we had to include interview guests because we meet so many incredible people all the time that are doing the same thing, that are thinking about all this crazy world that's just starting to emerge.
Wait, Jess, I think we talked to someone pretty cool this week. Could you tell us a little bit more about who that is?
Yeah, I feel like I secreted this into existence, to be honest with you. So if you don't know, I was working on Clyde's on Broadway this last winter, late winter, with Uzo Aduba. And we were doing a live simulcast of the play for the last 2 weeks of its run. And my team, my video supervisor, my show caller, and I, we were all like chatting about the nuances and idiosyncrasies of live switching software, and that it's not really made to withstand the pressure and force of live theater, which has lots and lots and lots of planned cues in it. And we got talking about QLab. If you're listening and you make theater, you're like, yeah, of course you got talking about QLab. It's the software that powers every single theater in the United States and probably all over the world, originally made for projections, but now runs sound cues and like just anything you can hook up MIDI. I mean, it does it all. And then I was tooling around on Twitter one day, Joe, which can just be a terrible, horrible place, but sometimes it really pulls through, and ran into this like smart guy named Chris Ashworth. And he was saying smart things about actually the ticket pricing model for Clyde's. And I was like, hey, I'm Jess. This is smart. Let's talk about this. And then I found out he was the founder of QLab.
What are the chances? Twitter is really a magical, horrible cesspool of a unicorn. Chris is like a cool dude, as you'll get to hear. He's a really unique mix of someone who is a trained theater actor, but he also has a computer science background, which like that intersection, it just feels right. It feels like home for us. So we are really super excited to hear his perspective on the future of digital events.
Yeah. And we don't really talk too much about this in the episode, so I do want to say and take this opportunity to say, so he's got this theater he founded in Baltimore called The Voxel. And like, if to your point, Joe, this is the exact kind of human we want to spend all our time with. This is his description of The Voxel. By day, The Voxel is the teaching center and research laboratory of Figure 53, which is the parent company of QLab. Their software runs live performances in over 100 countries around the world. By night, The Voxel is a theater, incubator, and resource for performing artists in Baltimore and across the country. How rad is that?
It's so rad. I really want to go in person.
Yes.
To The Voxel.
It's not that far away.
No, Baltimore's pretty close to New York City.
And I mean, Chris was pretty great. We really enjoyed this conversation. I feel like it could have gone on for another hour. We tried to not do that to you all listening, but it could have. We kept it tight, concise. And I actually think if you're thinking about live digital and sort of this ecosystem and arts and technology and what's possible, there's a lot of really, really good, juicy, meaty stuff that we get into in this conversation that I think will spark some interesting questions and ideas for you.
So we hope you enjoy getting together with Chris Ashworth.
Just Joe, Chris, Lucy, we've all met now. It's such a weird world where you're meeting people. There's like inceptions of meeting people for the first time, like people that you've only tweeted with and meeting them on a podcast, on a video. And then we're having people to the office for the first time. We've like literally done dozens of shows with across these last 2 years. And this must happen to you all the time, I imagine, Chris. You seem like a prolific tweeter in this environment of theater and technology.
maybe, I don't know. I sort of quit Twitter before, and then the pandemic hit and I was like, I need adult interaction because I only have my two small kids at home. And so I sort of feel gross when I'm on Twitter because sometimes it brings out, you know, like there's a lot of negativity on there. So there's a lot of temptation to get involved in that, and sometimes I don't feel so good about that. So I actually just kind of like stepped away from Twitter again, and I'm trying to stay. I'm just like yesterday, I'm trying to like chill out about Twitter. So
glad that Jess caught you so that we can have this conversation before you jump back off Twitter.
yeah. No, it was cool running into you, totally. And then I was listening to your podcast, and I was like, oh, these are my people. So it's great to say hi.
I'm so excited to talk. And so like, let's get the it's not boring, but the like admin stuff out of the way in case someone's listening to this, like doesn't know who Chris Ashworth is and is going to go find podcasts, you know, after this and listen to all the incredible smart things you have to say. What's the short description of who you are that you would like people to know?
Okay. The thing most people know me as is the guy who created QLab. So this is the piece of software that runs sound and video and sometimes lights for live theater, and that's my main thing that people know. I have a background in theater, mostly as an actor, but then I went off and did computer science or just learned to program more. Not really science, they call it that, but it's not. You're just learning a program. There's not that much science involved, and went off and kind of did both for a while. Now I have this job with a team. Now it's not just me making QLab, and I sort of try to keep myself involved in all of it as much as I can. So yeah.
Can we go back to the actor part and have to apologize to Joe, my co-founder, who comes from tech and media, is slowly but surely becoming one of us, makers of broadcasts and theater and all of that. But
it's been a fun 2 years, Chris. Yeah. It's been a fun 2 years.
But maybe sometimes I feel like I'm about to make a reference that's like not going to be solidly in his wheelhouse. I'm really sorry, Joe, and I'll explain anything you want to know more about later. But I was reading one of your interviews. You were talking about all this technical stuff on QLab, and then you were like, bam, Anne Bogart. And I have to tell you something, like, because I also was an actor first and still do act, just like not with the same frequency. I always reference her in meetings, and I've never seen another like founder of a company reference Anne Bogart. And now I don't feel so alone in the world. And I just want you to talk a little bit about your love for Anne Bogart to make me feel better.
I mean, what's there to say? She's awesome. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and she did a lot of work at Actors Theater of Louisville. The city company did a lot of work there. And I didn't know, there's still so much about theater that I don't know. I'm so ignorant about almost everything, including theater. And so I don't have a broad knowledge about theater, which is embarrassing, but I know about her stuff because I got to see a bunch of it and I was an apprentice at Actors Theater. And so I got to train like a little bit when I was apprentice there with some of those company members. And it's just like, you know, lots of people love City Company, but I also love City Company. I mean, it's just cool. Like the way that she approaches some of that stuff, like I've seen her talk about one approach that she sometimes uses is, well, to like overload an actor with more than they can do until they just can't handle it anymore. So it pulls them out of their out of their head and, like, you know, give them, if they can manage 8 things at one time, give them 10, and then it's interesting. Because then they're no longer self-aware and they're just desperately trying to keep up with the 10 things you told them to do, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just like, I really like physical theater and like a physical approach to making work. And she certainly taps into that with the viewpoints and things like that. So I don't know, it checks a lot of boxes for me.
That's so awesome. I'm trained in Suzuki, which is how I came to Bogart. And it's the same thing. And why those two companies, Tadashi and Anne, work together is because that's also what Suzuki does. Except, well, no, it's the exact same thing. Physically overload your body so that you can no longer think about what you're doing as an actor.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I spent a lot of time during that year as an apprentice stomping on the floor doing Suzuki stuff. And I was like, this is okay. All right. We'll just keep. I know this probably makes no sense, man. I'm sorry.
A sort of thing that people into?
Yes. Yeah.
Or is this like you walk in and you're like, why am I being abused right now? What is happening?
You know, a little calm B.
I also did it when I was apprentice. I don't remember how Actors Theater works, but certainly at the Berkshire Theater Festival. I mean, I went and worked for free in order to do that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, they don't do that anymore. They discontinued all that because kind of someone realized like, oh, this is a little sketchy to not pay people. But back when I was doing it, it was, you worked for 10 months for free and there was no time to do anything else. I think you had like 2 guaranteed days off, which was Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, but I was in A Christmas Carol, so I did not get those days off.
Solid. I feel like I'm going to show you some Suzuki. I think you would like it a lot, and I will go to a drop-in class with you if you ever want to try it.
Oh, I didn't even consider that this is a thing that I could like do in the present. Like the way you talk about it, you're both like, oh, I did this back in the past. It's in the past forever.
Still doing
I could go there later today, do some of this work, get yelled at by someone.
I think City's just remounting one of their shows right now in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah, they do drop-in classes and viewpoints and Suzuki. Anyway, it's really amazing. But something I reference often is like her sort of theories around needing fences, like Joe can confirm. I talk about this a lot.
Confirm.
Like fences and creativity, and that you have to destroy things, you know, make a thing, destroy it, and keep trying to create on top of it to really get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's really, really applicable in all of the places that we work. And I don't know if it's applicable in technology, but...
I mean, that's like the whole thing, right? Yeah, I mean, that's like iterate, repeat, iterate, iterate, fast iterations. Like just make something, make it bad, and then fix it just constantly. Yeah, totally.
Oh, and that sound that you just heard was Lucy's internet going out and cutting the recording. We can only assume that Joe asked a very intelligent and well-structured question about the development and founding of QLab, but the world will never know. So what do you have to say to that, Chris?
Yeah, I think... predominantly that. I think
just QLab, that's it.
Yeah, that's the whole deal. especially at the beginning, you know, now so we're it's about 16 years old now at this point from when I started writing code, which is crazy to think about. And these days we have a little more process on top of it to try to have a little more quality control, which is just a hard thing in software in general. It's very difficult to make software that doesn't break. It's just really hard to do and no one has figured it out yet. And so we do, like, there's a little more process now in terms of review and testing and cycles and blah blah blah, but in some ways, more often than not, there's a need to kind of continue to push back towards that original impulse of when I was first starting it, when it was just like, it was just me for a number of years. And it was just, you know, what did I build this weekend, put that out the door, what did I build in the next few days, put that out the door. And just, it was a lot easier to go fast and fix stuff and just keep going than it was to, because that's when you're figuring out what the problems are and what people actually want and trying to get something right slowly. And, you know, one big thing right that takes some time is oftentimes wasted effort, which is a clock. I mean, that's like established wisdom in software now, but it's true, you know, it's super true. Like just getting in there and building and building and iterating as fast as possible is often really constructive.
It's like a no-brainer that an artist would do this, right? Like it's just the same process on both sides. It is.
Maybe that's like a program we need to start where we take kids that majored in computer science or I guess in theater and performance and like cross-pollinate them in some way. Because Chris, like you, I feel like were probably super rare for a while. Like someone who was an actor, was in the theater, but also learned this other skill. And we're meeting more and more of those people that have this interesting crossover. But it feels like an area, theater specifically, that's like ripe for this sort of innovation.
Sure. I mean, and there's probably, maybe it's theater specifically, or maybe it's just like combined two unusually combined things that aren't usually combined. You know, like when I talk to people, I mean, there's so many computer nerds who write programs for other computer nerds, because that you want to write programs that you know what the problem is, like you understand the problem. But there's a lot of people who are just like, there's so many of us that just understand those problems. And that is sort of saturated with like tools for people who already know and care about and work with computers. And so if you can combine, like it looks like what you're doing is combining sort of like what I was doing, is like expertise in theater, expertise in programming. And when you do the overlap is when there's new stuff that's interesting. So, I kind of feel like it doesn't have to be uniquely theater, or it's not necessarily special in that way. It's just anything that doesn't usually get an overlap with programming, there's some set of problems where then something interesting happens. And then there's the flip side of that, which is like someone who writes programs tends to especially earlier in our career, tends to think that you can solve everything by writing more programs. And then like learning to figure out like, okay, which of the things don't need new programs and which of the things that do need new programs?
Yeah, I had a boss who was a bit of a technophobe, and he would always be like, sometimes he's got to pick up the phone. Sometimes he's got to talk to someone on the phone. And we were all about like, no, text, Slack, email, this, that. And I was like, nope, he was right. There's some things, you just got to pick up the phone.
Yeah. I mean, and it's tempting too, because it is a superpower. Like it is, it's totally a super, like when you can train and study the incantations and go into your lair and put all the incantations together in for the right thing, then it just magically suddenly is just unleashes this power for good or for ill. So it is totally like a magical superpower, but it's learning when and how to identify it, when to deploy it, and when it's the right thing and when it's maybe it's not. I don't know.
That thing that you're talking about too, like understanding the value of two different things coming together and what happens out of it, like that feels also like an artist skill set solidly, right? That is every time we go into the room as an actor or a director or a designer, well, not every time in the best of the cases, but many of the times in my life, that's the example that was set for me, right? Is like, we can't make the thing without all of us coming to this from very different places. And I'm just thinking of the director-actor relationship because it's the one that's most familiar to me. You know, even those cases in which a director, like one of the earliest lessons you learn, hopefully, is the director's going to give you a note. You're not going to understand their perspective and you don't know what they're thinking about, and you're going to want to argue back, but you just shush for a little bit and give it a think and see what you can do with it. And even if you didn't have a plan or you definitely thought it was wrong, 9 times out of 10, if you'll just follow that and like value the information coming from the other way and try to use it alongside what you're bringing to it, something spectacular happens.
Yeah, totally. Totally. If you take the note, man, and that's one of the hardest lessons to learn too, is so hard. Taking the note, because I mean, I still have those like cringy memories of early auditions where I was like, thought I was doing pretty well in an audition, and then the director gave me a note and I didn't take it. And I kind of just repeated the thing I'd done before, and you could just see them be like, thank you. Nope. Yep. No, because once you get in the room, you're gonna just get locked into what you think you need to be doing, and just gonna keep doing that over and over again, and I'm not gonna have any input on you trying something that you're not thinking about.
Yep.
And having to live through not taking the note a couple times and not getting the part is just like, it's a hard lesson. It's a hard lesson.
It's true. Or being embarrassed in front of the entire rehearsal room, as it was my case, the last time I had to learn that lesson.
Sure.
Where someone, the director was like, no, I need you to be quiet, take that note and come back and try it. And I was like, okay.
Wait, what did you actually do in that situation such that they had to come back and be like, no, take the damn note?
I was playing someone older than me and they gave me a note and I was like, she wouldn't do that. And they were like, that old chestnut. Whoops. The last time I ever said that in a rehearsal room.
Yeah.
Because you know what? Exactly what I said. I got embarrassed. I cried. I was really embarrassed because she was really mad at me. My director taught me that lesson. I went away, I thought about it, I came back in, and it transformed that entire freaking performance of the song. Like, it was a whole, you know, a whole thing. So I really value that. And I think, like, particularly in the digital sphere, and I think I feel like I see that a lot in your conversations that I've seen and creeped on Twitter. Because I'm also not on Twitter a ton, but enough to, like, poke around. That just in this digital realm, there's such a collaboration between disciplines and, like, thought processes, because it's inherently performance and technology, you know, and you kind of can't have one without the other.
Yeah. Well, wait, tell me more about that. Tell me more what you're thinking there.
Well, like, specifically, here's an example that just happened today. We had a bunch of stage managers in the office, because we you know, reached out to the databases and interviewed a bunch of people. We need to just, like, have more people on our roster. So that's their skill set, production stage management. But they've all dabbled around with tech. So, like, we think they're capable of being what is called in our world a production live stream manager, which is just the equivalent of that job. And we were on on a glossary page on the suggestion of one of our production stage managers who's worked with us, because she was like, I know what the fuck you were talking about any of the time. And as we were going through the items today in the glossary, I was realizing that, like, the words you have to know and the concepts you have to understand to work in our world span from TV, film, theater, to technology, concepts like VPNs and RTMP protocol, right? Like, I know I just was redundant, but you know what I mean. Like, in a way that you just don't quite have in the same way with theater, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was sort of thinking of, is that there's just this, like, collision of disciplines together.
Yeah, there's, and especially right now, there's a collision. There's a new stuff getting added and colliding in a way that's not everyone's comfortable with yet. So, like, I think the whole streaming thing, like this whole discussion about streaming period, is clearly it's either inventing a new category or adjusting old categories or something in a way that everyone sees there's something going on, but we're not all sure how we relate to it yet. Or you know, like, people want to produce stuff in that way, but not everyone is sure how they're comfortable producing stuff in that way. And then, you know, yeah, there's a lot of collision happening right now, for sure.
I wonder how, like, the adoption will happen. Like, as you both were talking, my mind was imagining, like, these sort of celestial bodies, like, all circling each other, right? Like, film, theater, technology. And, like, if they were to come crashing together, right? If it's, like, Earth crashing into the sun, like, the sun just kind of absorbs Earth and maybe there's a little extra hydrogen. And so it's, like, theater adopts a few terms. And they're like, okay, great, we've integrated the term live stream. Great, done. Like, that's it. Right. Or is it, like, they're going to crash together, explode, and create a whole new sort of set of stars or something like that? And, like, I hope that's the direction it's going to go. All these worlds are going to crash together. People like us that find it interesting and are willing to sort of, like, kill ourselves inventing and learning, adopting all the different terms and technologies, you know, me going toward theater, Jess going where the heck she's going.
That sounds about right.
And, you know, creating a whole brand new thing. And that's my hope, that, like, we're inventing a whole new world.
Well, the people who aren't scared of it are doing it, right? I mean, the people who aren't scared of it are just doing it now. And one reason that some of them aren't scared of it is that maybe they have less to lose, you know? So I see younger people or smaller scale in terms of monetary production, they're just jumping in. Because they're like, this is just a new version of the thing we're already, you know, here's an exciting new idea. Do people want to potentially engage this way? Sure, why not? There's nothing for us to lose here. And then it sort of seems like people who have more to lose, it's scarier, because it feels like, okay, maybe this is exciting, but also it could destabilize the thing we already have. And if it does so in a good way, cool. Like, we want this to succeed. But if it does so in a way where we either lose power, lose money, or lose ground, then that's scary. So there's sort of like a protective thing happening for maybe, you know, I mean, I'm seeing that's at the, like, higher production end of, you know, like, equity, actors' equity, trying to develop their understanding of how actors relate to streaming, which feels, for a lot of people, it feels like that's a slow moving process right now. And probably other stakeholders as well. So yeah, like, there are people who are just, like, jumping for it. And then there are people who are interested, but they're more nervous. and maybe more slow moving. I don't know. But it does seem like it's kind of, I mean, it's inevitable, right? Like, it's just like, I mean, this, that's the sort of silly thing. It's like, obviously this is going to happen, guys. Come on. Come on. Like, get real. This is going to happen.
But maybe, I mean, maybe what you're describing is this tension that exists at the something that's so specific to digital media, which is that, like, we've got the art form. There is a new art form, right?
Sure.
And there's also a new model and revenue stream because it's scalable, right, in some way.
Sure. Right.
And it feels like what you're talking about, young folks, companies with not a huge financial stake, not many of them are really, that I've seen, working to retrofit and develop the revenue stream. They're mm-hmm. developing the art form, mm-hmm. whereas the companies with bigger financial risk are due, with the exception of like Geffen and OSF and a couple of these, you know, awesome institutions that have just like put a pot of money to mm-hmm. develop the art form, which I think is like totally the way to go. The retrofitting is far more in the revenue streams, mm-hmm. you know, model of like expand butts in seats basically and mm-hmm. drive more revenue, right? I mean, this is really Joe's territory, so look out. I'm probably just saying things that are dangerous, but that's my thought. Is there some tension between those two things that exist in this new world?
Yeah. I don't know. What are you finding? Like, or Joe, what do you think?
It's funny. I got thinking, and Jess, thanks for opening the space for me, but also I thought you handled it perfectly. I've got nothing better to add to what your point is, but I was thinking about sort of like the pipeline element of how theater works. And again, a thing I've been learning more about that I find super, super interesting. And our friend and colleague, Steph Cowan, is really, really invested in sort of like the pipeline of theater and the idea that someone somewhere is creating something with a screen in mind. And how can we sort of continue to help and incubate that? Because there is an existing pipeline and it is, you know, has its problems. But is that how it's going to have to work in the short term? Younger, more creative, not more creative, younger, more technologically savvy people are going to be the ones creating things on a much smaller scale. And they're slowly going to, in a lowest risk possible way, sort of inch up the ladder to the next thing and inch up the ladder into the regional theater and inch up and inch up and inch up until 10 years from now, 15 years from now, it's actually showing up in a Broadway theater. Mm-hmm. Because just to your point, Krista, what you said, there's just so much risk for these theaters that their revenue model is figured out. Like, they know how to make back their nut. They know how much things should cost. Like, to sort of tweak and twist and pull a column out, like, it could bring the whole thing down. And like, we're just going to wait. We're going to wait and see what happens. That leaves an opening and an opportunity in my mind for someone to win and to make that work. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're all doing right now.
Yeah. And there may not be space. Like, at least some folks that I talk to feel like there isn't space to even try it, right? So like, there isn't a chance of breaking it. There's just nowhere to fit it. So the cost to produ- like the cost to pay artists sufficiently and the cost to create what they feel is a satisfactory production quality. Mm-hmm. And then where's the, if the additional revenue to cover those costs doesn't show up from some source, then that's just like, well, then we can't do it. The mm-hmm. end. Like, that's it. So where those levers get pulled and where the dials get tweaked are, you know, can be things like, to my mind, things like the production cost to get a high quality production. To me, that's a place there's going to be movement, right? Because it's like, to get in a team to create something that would like go on PBS or whatever, like there are known costs to get like a broadcast quality such and such stream. Mm-hmm. Now, whether your institution needs that is a question, right? Like, right. like the accessibility of cameras that can do 4K quality, and then like the production costs get cheaper over time. Like, we see that technologically, production costs get cheaper over time. The quality gets higher, the costs get lower. So I think that's going to move. Also, there's like, as we understand how to build out systems that you can get higher quality with like, you know, I don't know, just less resources, like that cost is going to go down. So I think that's going to move. The other thing is, so part of the cost of paying artists adequately just isn't figured out yet. Like, it's absolutely critical. No one who's worth talking to doesn't want to pay artists well. And I'm sure there are some producers out there who have a lot of power and under that definition are not worth talking to. And I could say that because I don't give a shit, but they still got to use QLab. So I'm not saying that everyone is an honest and faithful actor here, but I do think that there are plenty of smart people who want to solve this problem who all agree that paying artists is part of the is an ethical part of the solution, ethical necessity for any solution we want to consider, but may not agree on how to get there. So, actors' equity, as I just said a moment ago, it sounds like they're being cautious. I don't know the details of actors' equity thinking here. I'm very much an outsider, but when I talk to other producers or artists or people who want to push the field, that name comes up and they say, oh, you know, we can't film a production without paying them $250,000 up front, instead of saying, here are the recording costs, and then there will be a pay-per-view model that you get a cut of in perpetuity. So like, there are potentially models here that could pay artists sufficiently without front-loading costs. So that might be a cost that can come down in the production side, not necessarily in the eventually paying out lots of money to artists side, like, because we want that if we're ethical. So there, like, those two costs can be tweaked. And then, as you were saying, like, the whole revenue question of where does the revenue come in? What are the revenue models? Is it a subscription model? I hope not, because that's like ruined music. And is it a pay-per-view? I hope it's something more like that. And what are the details of it? Is it unlimited tickets? Is it limited tickets? Is it both different categories, some unlimited, some limited? Is it, you know, like all these million questions that come up when you start trying to price, like, how do you get people to pay what they think it's worth to see a show, which is the endless unanswerable question that you just keep trying to get slightly, slightly better answers to. And then that part we're still desperately trying to figure out. There, solved it.
Nailed it.
Yeah, we'll say if it's on the internet, I want it to be free.
Right.
And that's I think a big part of the problem.
Well, is it? But wait, so who's I? Break that down though. Like, who is saying that? Are you personally saying that?
Like the joke coming from sort of like the ad supported ecosystem that the internet grew up around, and the sort of freemium model, or not even freemium, just like free, and pay with your attention.
And that's how
digital media like has been structured, like from the ground up, and that's built into our expectations of how we consume our media through screens. And so, like, that's actually, I think, a world where we can like kind of pull from, you know, the film and theater world, and be like, okay, we're going to try to adopt a little bit more of that language, where it's like, no, you're paying for something, and a big part of what we think about is how do you make it worthwhile? Like, what justifies that being paid for? Is it that you get some sort of digital memorabilia? Is it that the experience is somehow tangible? Is it that you get physical memorabilia? I don't know what it is, but something has to be in there to break the connection that we have with our sort of, I go to YouTube and I watch a thing for free, but sometimes there's an ad on it. I go to Facebook and I see things for free, but sometimes there's an ad on it. I look at 99 cent on the App Store and I go, do I actually need this? Can I find a free version?
Yeah. This is tough because, man, like, attention is so cheap these days. Like, it's valued very little. This is a huge, like, one of the things I was thinking about this in contrast with QLab, because QLab is a tool. It's such a different story. Like, people can connect very clearly what value that they get out of paying us for this tool that we make, and then what they then make with the tool, and how it's a huge multiplier of what they do. So like, they pay us, you know, a few hundred dollars for the tool we make, and then they create unlimited numbers of productions that are worth way more than that per production because of how it enhanced their production. And that's like a really easy utility to understand. But when it comes to these things that are more like I'm essentially in a business to business kind of model where I'm selling to businesses, and theaters are in this business to consumer kind of model where it's like, you know, it's a much bigger collection of people who might want to pay some money for the thing you're doing, but it's a much harder sell. And it's not a utility cell. It's this more ephemeral, like, why do you value it? Why do you care? Why is your attention on this? Is it because you have a relationship with us in the real world? Is it because we're in the same city and you have, and, you know, which, and it brings up all these questions of things like, you know, the loss of the model, the theatrical model of in-house acting companies, right? Mm-hmm. Like how everything in regional theaters got transitioned into just hiring folks from New York that you ship in for, and so you just new people every time. So so I grew up with a theater that when I was growing up, I went and saw almost always the same actors every time for every show, for dozens and dozens of shows. And there was something interesting about seeing what they did in different shows. And then now if you go back to the same theater, you'll never see the same actor twice. And so like, it's only a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of that puzzle, but there's something about the relationship with those people in my city where maybe that helps me establish the value of like, I want to be able to check in with that particular organization, whether it's in person or whether it's digitally. I have more of an established relationship. Like, how is my attention being drawn to what you're doing? Like, why do I care? Why? I have so many things for my attention to go into. And that's just like, this, that's a, I don't know. I mean, but on the other hand, so when you were originally saying, I should shut up and let you talk because I'm like, you're getting me all excited about
that's
all this
not
topic.
What this is about.
Okay. You're getting me all excited. No, but like when you originally were saying that, so I think one of the things that we originally bumped into each other on Twitter about, Jessica, was this question. I don't even remember what the specific topic was, but it was essentially questions of streaming and pricing online tickets and
forced scarcity.
Like, yeah. Is that bad? Is it good? Like, it seems on the face of it, maybe it's silly that thing which is clearly unlimited in fundamental nature. Like, we're not going to run out of electrons to send down the wire. why would that be limited? Well, so our brains, maybe, I mean, to advocate as why this might actually be a good thing is our brains like activate when there's like a scarcity of a resource. Like, it suddenly becomes a little more interesting, a little more like it draws my attention. It sharpens it to go, I actually have to pay attention to that to decide whether I want to try to access it or not. And if that's a tool, like, separate from questions of accessibility, which are good and valid questions, but if that's a tool that can sharpen attention to generate some amount of value to make the art happen, maybe that's a good thing, right? So that, like, I don't know what the answer is going to be. And that's the whole point, is we have to be trying a million things and figuring out what the answer is, because none of us know. And anyone who's like, well, if you do this, it's going to work, is lying, because they don't know. But like, one of these things is going to work. So if one of the things might be that the example that I was throwing out on Twitter, which may be totally wrong, but just demonstrates the point that I'm trying to make, is like, we're entering into an age in which really high resolution streaming, for example, is a thing that's going to become more standard and more accessible in more households. So like 4K streaming or whatever, you know, like some, whatever, 8K, I don't know. They make cameras that do 8K.
Fuck it, 16K.
Recording. Fuck it, 16K.
All the case. Metaverse live streaming.
And you can get your 8K stream on your, and there's no 8K projectors yet, but you know, whatever. But the point being that there's going to be some numbers of Ks that is like people can get. That's good. That's nice. Like 4K looks good. And maybe that's the thing that's limited. If you really care about this production, maybe there are only 60 tickets for digital 4K streaming, mm-hmm. and they cost a lot. Because if you have access to that and you're willing to pay, do it, right? Like, there are people out there who are not, there are plenty of people for whom cost is a boundary that they need to be really careful about. And there are a lot of other people that don't have that. And the whole point of like the whole magic of pricing is trying to figure out what you personally, what the value is for you and what an appropriate price is for you. Like, ideally, I would be charging a slightly different price to every person on earth if that felt fair to them, right? Like, mm-hmm. like, like
Like the pay what you want for the Radiohead kind of album situation.
It's, there's not an inherent price that is like the truth of what the price should be. So maybe the limited thing is like there's 60 tickets of this high resolution thing and it costs a ton. And then there's unlimited tickets of the low resolution thing for as many people as want to see it. And that costs very little. And maybe the combination of those is the best of both worlds. And we can use that scarcity to say the scarcity sharpens my attention, makes me think about what I care about and whether I value it. And if I'm excited about it, it makes it a little more precious. It feels more precious. There's not as many of that available. Like if I get a slot, I get one of the 60 slots, like I'm having a special experience. Like that's special too. Like that's not to be scoffed at. That could be a good and helpful and valuable thing and special thing. So I'm ranting. But
I want to jump in on the scarcity part because I loved like watching your brain just like be as human as possible. It was like scarcity. I need it. And like we're like, I don't know why I need it. I just need it because you told me there's only 60 of them.
Yeah.
And my thought immediately went to, oh, I hope like one of my like incredibly wealthy friends that I don't have yet made like will invite me over to their 4K streaming in their in person their like home theater or whatever it is, which got me to could we adopt like the movie theater model for this sort of a thing? Like there's people all over the country who cannot and will not be coming to New York to see a Broadway show. And if we can prove that to the theaters, like, hey, this person would never be coming otherwise. So just take their money in, you know, Kansas City or wherever they are to actually beam something in into their city and into their theater and have a communal experience. But unfortunately, the actors are not technically on that stage. But it looks real damn good because it's in 400K.
Well, there's some there's some operas doing that. Like, I think does that. So they like my parents-in-law live in Gettysburg and could go down to the local cinema and watch the Met Opera like live cast high resolution. I mean, like that specific thing actually has happened. And like in addition to that, yes, and you know my buddies who. Like friends from college who live in Minnesota who make big programming bucks and are never gonna go to see a show in New York City because they live in freaking Minnesota and they don't wanna go to New York City, but they have a lot of disposable income, which goes a lot further because they don't live in New York City. And they'd be delighted to watch high quality shows streaming as an option. You know, like there's just like, if we can. Them figuring out where the shows are right now is a huge problem because there's no centralized place to do it. There's no place to be like, I would like to watch streamed theater. What's available right now? That doesn't exist, which is a huge problem. But if it did, or if there was a way to solve that problem, there's plenty of people who make enough money. I mean, people
it's a classic like, two-sided marketplace issue. It's like, well, they're not going to build the infrastructure without the demand, but the demand can't flourish if there's no infrastructure. And so they kind of have to like build at the same time.
Sometimes I'm like, people who work in theater, do you understand how much money some other kinds of people make? It's a lot of money. Like, do you understand that Google engineers are making $500,000 a year minimum?
And there's a lot of them.
I mean... And they don't.
It's all going into the houses that they're buying, unfortunately. Sure. No room for theater tickets.
That's because we didn't give them the theater option.
less so now that it's a pandemic and companies are having to like allow remote work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so I, you know, sometimes I'm like, I mean, theater's hard. It's hard to get. I don't know. It's you don't go into theater because you want to make a lot of money.
No.
But there are people who do make money, and they don't necessarily live in your town. And they might want to watch theater.
They love the so many
Let's
people.
Let's give it a try.
I want to say, too, on this, something that I thought was really cool. And this is on the, I was going to say this earlier. Joe calls the less easy things to quantify, he calls it squishy things. Like, that's what we often refer to as squishy. Mm-hmm. Mostly when I start talking and he's like, oh, okay, we're talking about squishy things now. And I'm like, that's right. You got the artist in charge of this company. You're welcome. But one of the like squishier things that happened on this ticket pricing conversation that you and I got into that I thought was super cool is that, so Broadway Unlocked, our first company, started focused purely on live broadcast and what happens when you mix the theater like modality with live broadcast. It was about the show, it was about the performance, it was about that new art form, right? But when the pandemic hit and Joe and I met, we both sort of agreed that the next big question, because we were privileged to have figured a lot out about the broadcast, always learning, always feel like I actually don't know anything, but like we knew a lot going in. But the next big question was, if live digital is going to exist as a medium, what is the digital audience's experience? How do you help them feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves, even when they're just by themselves in their living room? Because that's going to be the key to like a sustainable actual, like driving traffic to want this kind of stuff. And that's why we created All Together Now, which is like purely focused on that side of the question, right? And so what I think is so fascinating out of what happened with Clyde's and these $59 streaming tickets, which is what we're actually talking about currently, that was very expensive for streaming, right? But then I saw this once I found your conversation about forced scarcity, people talking about how they invited friends to their house to split the ticket. And not only does that make it affordable, but it starts solving that squishy thing of like, how do I feel like I'm part of something a little bigger than just me?
Yep.
And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, suddenly $60 ticket sounds like kind of a cheap deal. Like you have four friends over and you're like hanging out in your living room watching a live stream.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good deal to me and fun. I mean,
way fun.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
And that feels like a happy accident from like this decision to make these tickets so expensive.
Right? Exactly. That's not the thing you sit down and go like when you're trying. I mean, and I've been there before, like we've all been there when we're trying to imagine the new modalities, the new forms. I mean, this is like back to Chekhov and Treplev and, you know, new forms, we need new forms. And that's just always true. Like we're always growing in about new forms and stuff. So we're always like trying to invent like what's the new digital streaming form. And it's always going to be so overly influenced by the things we already understand, like recreating the physical experience in some over, you know, maybe heavy-handed way or whatever it is. And then instead we like, if we throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and we start noticing, well, wait, like you just did, like, I didn't think about that until someone said it. Oh, $60, that's expensive, but $60 split three ways, cheap, and my friends are over. Like, oh, okay, that was the thing. I couldn't see it clearly, but that was the thing. Or whatever the thing is going to end up being. Totally. I see
an idea of like hybridizing ticket sales with those like subscription boxes that people love, where it's like, buy a ticket, get this box sent to your house for your party that you're going to throw because you bought this ticket.
Because you had to split the ticket price.
Yeah. We're like six or seven steps away from that one, so but I'm excited for it to go there.
But it also could just be simple stuff too. Like when people being in a chat room together to watch a Twitch stream, that's presence. Mm-hmm. I mean, like being able to talk with the production. So so I just built a theater in right before the pandemic hit. I just
congrats.
Finished building a theater. Thanks. I guess. Oh man, that's a whole episode. That's a whole therapy session talking about that. But like, we did a couple of things this fall when COVID was dying down a little bit. May we reach that point again. And I had to actually stay home for one of the, there was an orchestral concert in the space and I had a COVID exposure. I couldn't go to the actual show. And so I had to watch the live stream on Twitch. And it was like, I'm just in this chat room, but it's, I'm present in time, which matters. I'm not present in space, but I'm present in time. And that feels different from a recording. I don't know why. It is presence. I'm with you at the same time. And there was this sideband channel of people chatting on Twitch about like reacting in ways that were like, we would not necessarily feel comfortable reacting like that in the room. So we were able to like kind of do the digital equivalent of make some noise and cheer and like react live with other people. Like we could, you know, do the fire emojis and the this and then that and be like that, you know, this, you know, the rapper who was rapping during this part of the orchestral piece or this singer, like, wow, like, whoa, what's happening right now? And we were like, that was a connected moment in a chat room. And then there was this totally other layer that I wasn't expecting where because the technical, like we were connected to the tech crew. In a way that I have definitely never been at a live theater where it was like, oh, the audio, could you all adjust the audio? Like the mix is a little different from what I want. Could you all like bring up such and such in the mix? And they could respond. Like, that's not an experience.
Right. Wow.
That is really cool.
That I'm ever having at in an actual physical space. So there's, that was very much like I was kind of really present in the room because it, like, we could like chat into the little box and it was a changing something about what was physically happening in the room, and not in like a interactive, like press this button on your phone to
make them
send
a
message. To like make the actor step 3 steps backwards or whatever it was. But it was like definitely effective and live. So, I mean, a chat room, that's boring, but it was really compelling. Like, it's boring from a like product feature list, but not from the actual experience. It was like, no, this is great. This is
going to be like one of the things that we say so often, and that I love personally, is that like the technology is like cool and interesting, but it's what you do with it. It's like the human element of what you do with the technology that makes it cool and interesting. And that's exactly what you're saying. You're like, this chat box is the most boring thing from a product feature capabilities, but like, because you put a bunch of humans in there and they're bouncing off of each other and talking to the tech guys to get the sound levels changed, like it became this amazing experience through a little window on your screen.
I mean, the absolute biggest sign that it's not going to be interesting artistically is if you're thinking about the technology. Yeah. I mean, it is the least interesting thing. No one gives a fuck about the technology. I don't, unless you're the nerd making it, no one cares.
That's so true.
I picked up that we're allowed to curse on this podcast. I hope that's
100%.
True.
Yes.
Because
do you know Theater Me Too?
No.
Oh, God. Oh, okay. I'm going to change your life. They're amazing. They've been around for 20 years, specifically at the intersection of technology and theater for like the last decade. But anyway, the founder, I was just like listening to them do a live chat about stuff. And he said, the minute you approach technology as a tool to achieve your artistic goal, it's the land of sorrows. As soon as you look at that piece of technology as a collaborator, anything is possible. And I was like, that was really pretty and I liked it.
There you go.
And it reminded me of a lot of people we've worked with across the last couple of years that were lost in the land of sorrows.
I mean, it's hard. Like, there's a case to be made that I'm single-handedly responsible in some significant way for a lot of video projection in theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more so than say our random other person on the street. And I typically hate it. Like, it's so easy to have bad video projection because it's so often is like, and I'm watching a thing on a screen. It just happens to be a screen on like this little part of the stage, but I'm like, I'm pulled out of being in the physical space. So, you know, like it's hard, like this stuff, even for technology that's been around a long time at this point or much longer, it can still be hard to deploy it in a way that's about the art, about the experience. I mean, this isn't stuff we're going to get right away. We're going to have to keep trying it and figure out which things are pulling my experience out of the art and which things are supporting becoming immersed in the art. And I know I got to stop talking because we're...
And it's been really fun to talk to you. And if our listeners on this podcast want to be able to find you, where should they go look?
Sure. If you want to find, so there's 3 places you can look. So there's the main one is the QLab website, which is qlab.app, QLAB.APP. That's our product. The company is figure53.com. And then the theater that I built that may someday be a theater, if the pandemic ever stops, is voxel.org, voxel.org. So you can check those things out. Say hi.
I can't. Jess and I are going to come visit your Voxel. It's going to be good.
That'd be great. Thanks for chatting. This has been really fun. I hope
this was really, really fun.
I really enjoyed it. I feel like I talked way too much. You got me too excited.
I feel like you nailed it. I mean, we want your perspective, right? Okay. Our perspectives don't matter nearly as much.
Yeah, well, I was so interested listening to you guys that in the middle of this, I was like, I want to be listening to them. Like, I know what I think about this stuff. I want to know what they think.
I loved that conversation. I feel like I'm always so excited to talk to curious folks, and he was the example of that for me. He kept saying, wait, I don't want to talk about myself. I want to ask you guys questions. We're like, nope, we are here to interview you, sir. The spotlight is on you.
And it was a spotlight well shown, I feel like. Like, he had so many smart and interesting things to say around forced scarcity and pricing models. And what were the things, Jess, that you remember?
Well, I actually was just thinking about how, and wondering from your perspective, how much did this remind you of talking to folks like where in the industry you've come from? Because like in our world, it's well, it has been rare. I think it's becoming more commonplace. But to find someone like him who's like a creative and a technologist, really, like an engineer. But I feel like I might be misstating this, but I feel like from listening to your stories of all the startups, particularly the video-based platform startups that you came up through, that this was kind of like a pretty commonplace like intersection of a person you'd run into. Is that true or did I just make that up?
Feels a little made up, but I think I see a truth in there as well.
Thank you.
There's this sort of archetype of a startup founder, and they have to have the technical chops because they're just the ones inventing a thing in their garage or in their basement. But they have that curiosity, that excitement that pulls from other spheres, other places inside of the world. And Chris definitely felt like that. He had multiple skill sets, and he was sort of the origin point and the coming together of those skill sets to create this amazing product, QLab.
Yeah. And I loved when he was talking about his like model for his business, because I feel like this is a conversation we have frequently. And I'd be really interested to know if y'all listening get into this yourselves, which is like, how big do we actually want to be? You know what I mean? And is just like massive, massive growth the answer for everyone? And that's not a leading question. I still don't know what I think about for us, but hearing about Chris's choice to just like build a thing that has mass adoption inside a particular niche, and then like just build a model to sustain that and keep, you know, obviously evolving it, but not necessarily to like grow unicorn style. I actually really, really enjoyed hearing about his perspective on that.
Me too. I really love the idea of a business that doesn't need to be one of these super mega unicorn venture capital, biggest business in the world sort of things. And instead, you can build something that works well, makes people money, makes people happy. Like, that's a great, great model.
It is. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget you can actually visit Chris in Baltimore. I don't know, we're blowing up his spot. Go visit Chris in Baltimore at the Voxel and see the cool work that they're doing there. And also, I know he says he's on and off Twitter. He's currently back on, just so you know, at the moment, and tweeting beautiful photos of birds. He's been bird watching lately, which I love. So you can also follow him at Chris_Ashworth. Sometimes he's there, sometimes he's not, but I promise you when he is on Twitter, it is excellent food for thought and great photos of birds.
I love this. Go check right now. Report back if he's on.
That was so much fun, Joe. Our second episode is done. Thank you all for listening and being a part of the get-together.
The goal of all of this is to bring people together and have these important conversations. LiveDigital will be part of our lives from now on. So share this with someone who's thinking about how to connect their communities outside of just the four walls of their companies.
I'm Jess.
And I'm Joe.
We'll see you back here next week.